This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, Azazel by Isaac Asimov. Copyright 1988 by Nightfall Incorporated. Narrated by John C. Reed. This book contains 221 pages on 6 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the table of contents, or at the second beep to locate the beginning of the book. This recording is tone indexed. The beginning of the introduction and of each story will be indicated by a beep, audible when your cassette player is in the fast forward or rewind mode. Annotation. Collection of 18 fantasy stories centers around Azazel, a 2-centimeter tall imp who can be conjured up only by George Bitternut. Azazel has the power to grant people their wish, but with unexpected results. 1988. From the book jacket. A small demon whose name is Azazel has magical powers that dazzle, but the people who strive to get them derive nothing much and are beat to a frazzle. Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov, renowned master of science fiction, now turns his fanciful pen and limitless imagination to fantasy, and gives us a captivating collection of 18 short tales sure to enchant all admirers of fine fantasy and the legions of Asimov fans alike. Meet Azazel, a 2-centimeter tall, fiery red imp possessed with an impetuous personality and marvelous magical powers. Able to be summoned at will only by George Bitternut, an eccentric linguist who has stumbled upon the ancient incantations for calling forth demons and sprites, Azazel will not permit his wondrous wizardry to be used for George's personal gain. He will, however, cast his spells for George's friends when they are in need. The only problem is, this otherworldly miracle worker has little understanding of earthly quirks and human foibles, and his well-intentioned tamperings invariably lead to hilarious and unexpected chaos. This devilish collection of stories follows the antic adventures and misadventures of Azazel and our beleaguered Mr. Bitternut as they good-heartedly attempt to alter the fates of some hapless acquaintances. Told with great fun and in the inimitable Asimov style, Azazel makes for hours of pure impish delight. About the author. Isaac Asimov is known and loved the world over for his more than 365 published books. He is the creator of the phenomenal Foundation saga, which continues with the recent publication of Prelude to Foundation. 17 of the tales in Azazel first appeared in the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction and Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine. The opening story in the collection, The 2-Centimeter Demon, was written expressly for this book. Other collections containing science fiction stories by Isaac Asimov. I, Robot, 1950. The Martian Way and Other Stories, 1955. Earth is Room Enough, 1957. 9 Tomorrows, 1959. The Rest of the Robots, 1964. Asimov's Mysteries, 1968. Nightfall and Other Stories, 1969. The Early Asimov, 1972. The Best of Isaac Asimov, 1973. By Jupiter and Other Stories, 1975. The Bicentennial Man and Other Stories, 1976. The Complete Robot, 1981. The Winds of Change and Other Stories, 1983. The Alternate Asimovs, 1986. And The Best Science Fiction of Isaac Asimov, 1986. Dedication. To Sheila Williams, the sweet managing editor of Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine. Contents. Side 1, Tone 1. Introduction. Side 1, Tone 2. The 2-Centimeter Demon. Side 1, Tone 3. One Night of Song. Side 1, Tone 4. The Smile That Loses. Side 1, Tone 5. To the Victor. Side 1, Tone 6. The Dim Rumble. Side 1, Tone 7. Saving Humanity. Side 2, Tone 1. A Matter of Principle. Side 2, Tone 2. The Evil Drink Does. Side 2, Tone 3. Riding Time. Side 3, Tone 1. Dashing Through the Snow. Side 3, Tone 2. Logic is Logic. Side 3, Tone 3. He Travels the Fastest. Side 4, Tone 1. The Eye of the Beholder. Side 4, Tone 2. More Things in Heaven and Earth. Side 4, Tone 3. The Mind's Construction. Side 4, Tone 4. The Fights of Spring. Side 5, Tone 1. Galatea. Side 5, Tone 2. And Flight of Fancy. Side 5, Tone 3. Introduction. In 1980, a gentleman named Eric Prater asked me to do a monthly mystery story for a magazine he was editing. I agreed, because I find it difficult to say no to nice people. And all the editors I have ever met have been nice people. The first story I wrote was a kind of fantasy mystery, featuring a small demon about 2 centimeters tall. I named it Getting Even, and Eric Prater accepted and published it. It featured a gentleman named Griswold as the narrator, and 3 men, including a first-person character who was me, although I never named myself, who were his audience. The 4 were described as meeting every week in the Union Club, and I intended the series to continue to feature the tales of Griswold in the Union Club. However, when I tried to write a second story involving the little demon of Getting Even, the new story was named One Night of Song, Eric said no. Apparently, a bit of fantasy was all right once, but he didn't want me to make a habit of it. I therefore put One Night of Song to one side and proceeded to write the series of mystery stories with no fantasy admixture at all. 30 of these stories, which Eric insisted be only 2,000 to 2,200 words long, were eventually collected in my book, The Union Club Mysteries, Doubleday, 1983. I did not include Getting Even, however, because since it featured the little demon, it didn't match the rest of the stories. Meanwhile, I was brooding about One Night of Song. I hate waste, and I can't endure leaving something I wrote unpublished if there is anything I can do to correct the situation. I therefore approached Eric and said, "That story, One Night of Song, which you rejected, may I publish it elsewhere?" He said, "Certainly, provided you change the name of the characters. I want your stories featuring Griswold and his audience to be exclusive in my magazine." So I did. I changed Griswold's name to George, and I kept an audience of only 1, the first-person character who was myself. That done, I sold One Night of Song to the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, FNSF. Then I wrote another story of the kind I now thought of as George and Azazel stories, Azazel being the name of the demon. This one, The Smile That Loses, was also sold to FNSF. But I also have a science fiction magazine of my own, Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, IASFM. And Shauna McCarthy, who was then the editor, objected to my having fiction in FNSF. I said, "But Shauna, these George and Azazel stories are fantasies, and IASFM publishes only science fiction." She said, "So change the little demon and its magic into a little extraterrestrial being with an advanced technology and sell the stories to me." So I did that. And since I was still crazy about the George and Azazel stories, I continued to write them. And now I can include 18 of these stories in this collection, Azazel. Only 18 are included because, without Eric's need for briefness, I was able to make the George and Azazel stories twice as long as my Griswolds. But again, I didn't include Getting Even, because that didn't quite have the flavor of the later stories. Having been the original inspiration of 2 different series, Getting Even had the sad fate of falling between 2 stools and not fitting into either set of descendants. Never mind, it's been anthologized, and it may yet appear in the future in other guises as well. Don't feel too sorry for it. There are some points I would like to make about the stories. Points you'll probably notice for yourself, but I'm a blabbermouth. 1. As I said, I omitted the first story I wrote about the little demon because it didn't fit. My beautiful editor, Jennifer Brell, insisted, however, that a first story was necessary to describe how George and I met, and how the little demon first entered George's life. Since Jennifer, although a model of sweetness, is not to be withstood when she clenches her little fists, I wrote a story, The 2-Centimeter Demon, which does as she asks, and it is inserted as the first story in the book. What's more, Jennifer decided that Azazel is definitely going to be a demon and not an extraterrestrial, so we are back in fantasy. Azazel is a biblical name, by the way, and Bible readers usually take it to be the name of a demon, though the matter is a bit more complicated than that. 2. George is pictured as a deadbeat of sorts, and I dislike deadbeats, and yet find George lovable. I hope you do, too. The first-person character, really Isaac Asimov, is often insulted by George, and invariably victimized by him to the extent of a few dollars, but I don't mind. As I explain at the end of the first story, his stories are worth it, and I make far more money out of them than I give to George, particularly since the giving is fictional. 3. Please be aware that the stories are intended to be humorous satires, and if you find the style overblown and un-Asimovian, that is on purpose. Consider this a warning. Don't buy the book expecting something else and then find yourself annoyed. And by the way, if you occasionally detect the faint influence of P.G. Wodehouse, believe me, that's not accidental. The Two Centimeter Demon. I met George at a literary convention a good many years ago, and was struck by the peculiar look of innocence and candor upon his round, middle-aged face. He was the kind of person, I decided at once, to whom you would give your wallet to hold while you went swimming. He recognized me from my photographs on the back of my books and greeted me gladly, telling me how much he liked my stories and novels, which, of course, gave me a good opinion of his intelligence and taste. We shook hands cordially, and he said, "My name is George Bitternut." "Bitternut," I repeated, in order to fix it in my mind. "An unusual name." "Danish," he said, "and very aristocratic. I am descended from Knut, better known as Canute, a Danish king who conquered England in the early 11th century. An ancestor of mine was his son, born on the wrong side of the blanket, of course." "Of course," I muttered, though I didn't see why that was something that should be taken for granted. "He was named Knut for his father," George went on, "and when he was presented to the king, the royal Dane said, 'By my halidom, is this my heir?' 'Not quite,' said the courtier who was dandling little Knut, 'for he is illegitimate, the mother being the launder woman whom you—' 'Ah,' said the king, 'that's better.' And better Knut he was known from that moment on, just that single name. I have inherited that name in the direct male line, except that the vicissitudes of time have changed the name to Bitternut." And his blue eyes looked at me with a kind of hypnotic ingenuousness that forbade doubt. I said, "Would you join me for lunch?" sweeping my hand in the direction of the ornate restaurant that was clearly intended only for the fat walleted. George said, "Don't you think that that bistro is a bit garish, and that the lunch counter on the other side might—" "As my guest," I added. And George pursed his lips and said, "Now that I look at the bistro in a better light, I see that it has a rather home-like atmosphere. Yes, it will do." Over the main course, George said, "My ancestor, Bette Knut, had a son, whom he named Swain, a good Danish name." "Yes, I know," I said. "King Knut's father's name was Swain Forkbeard. In modern times, the name is usually spelled Sven, S-V-E-N. George frowned slightly and said, "There is no need, old man, to parade your knowledge of these things. I accept the fact that you have the rudiments of an education." I felt abashed. "Sorry." He waved his hand in grand forgiveness, ordered another glass of wine, and said, "Swain Betterknut was fascinated by the young women, a characteristic all the Bitternuts have inherited, and he was very successful with them, I might add, as we have all been. There is a well-attested tale that many a woman, after leaving him, would shake her head admiringly and say, 'Oh, what a swain that is.' He was an archimage, too." He paused and said abruptly, "Do you know what an archimage is?" "No," I lied, not wishing to parade my knowledge offensively yet again. "Tell me." "An archimage is a master magician," said George, with what certainly sounded like a sigh of relief. "Swain studied the arcane and hidden arts. It was possible to do it then, for all that nasty modern skepticism had not yet arisen. He was intent on finding ways of persuading the young ladies to behave with that kind of gentle and compliant behavior that is the crown of womanhood, and to eschew all that was froward and shrewish. Ah, I said sympathetically. For this he needed demons, and he perfected means for calling them up by burning certain sweet shrubs and calling on certain half-forgotten names of power. And did it work, Mr. Bitternut? Please call me George. Of course it worked. He had demons in teams and shoals working for him, for, as he often complained, the women of the time were mule-headed and obstinate who countered his claim to be the grandson of a king, with unkind remarks about the nature of the descent. Once a demon did his thing, however, they could see that a natural son was only natural. I said, "Are you sure this is so, George?" "Certainly. For last summer I found his book of recipes for calling up demons. I found it in an old English castle that is in ruins now, but that once belonged to my family. The exact shrubs were listed, the manner of burning, the pacing, the names of power, the intonations, everything. It was written in Old English, Anglo-Saxon, you know, but I am by way of being a linguist, and..." A certain mild skepticism made itself felt. "You're joking," I said. His glance was haughty. "Why do you think so? Am I tittering? It was an authentic book. I tested the recipes myself." "And got a demon?" "Yes, indeed," he said, pointing significantly to the breast pocket of his suit coat. "In there?" George touched the pocket and seemed on the point of nodding when his fingers seemed to feel something significant, or perhaps failed to feel something. He peered inside. "He's gone," he said with dissatisfaction. "Dematerialized. But you can't blame him, perhaps. He was with me last night because he was curious about this convention, you know. I gave him some whiskey out of an eyedropper, and he liked it. Perhaps he liked it a little too much, for he wanted to fight the caged cockatoo in the bar and began squeaking opprobrious names at it. Fortunately, he fell asleep before the offended bird could retaliate. This morning he did not seem at his best, and I suppose he has gone home, wherever that might be, to recover." I felt a touch rebellious. Did he expect me to believe all this? "Are you telling me you had a demon in your breast pocket?" "Your quick grasp of the situation," said George, "is gratifying. How big was he?"
2 centimeters.
"But that's less than an inch." "Perfectly correct. An inch is 2.54 centimeters. I mean, what kind of a demon is 2 centimeters tall?"
"A small one," said George. "But as the old saying goes, a small demon is better than no demon."
"It depends on his mood."
"Oh, Azazel, that's his name, is a friendly demon. I suspect he is looked down upon in his native haunts, for he is extraordinarily anxious to impress me with his powers, except that he won't use them to make me rich, as he should out of decent friendship. He says his powers must be used only to do good to others."
"Come, come, George. Surely that's not the philosophy of hell." George put a finger to his lips. "Don't say things like that, old man. Azazel would be enormously offended. He says that his country is kindly, decent, and highly civilized, and he speaks with enormous respect of his ruler, whom he won't name, but whom he calls merely the All-in-All."
"And does he indeed do kindnesses?"
"Whenever he can. Take the case of my goddaughter, Juniper Penn."
"Juniper Penn?"
"Yes. I can see by the look of intense curiosity in your eye that you wish to know the story, and I will gladly tell it to you."
"Juniper Penn," said George, "was a wide-eyed sophomore at college when the tale I tell you opened. An innocent, sweet girl fascinated by the basketball team, one and all of whom were tall, handsome young men. The one of the team upon whom her girlish fancy seemed most fixed was Leander Thompson, tall, rangy, with large hands that wrapped themselves about a basketball, or anything else that was the size and shape of a basketball, which somehow brings Juniper to mind. He was the undoubted focus of her screaming when she sat in the audience at one of the games. She would speak to me of her sweet little dreams, for like all young women, even those who were not my goddaughters, she had the impulse to confide in me. My warm but dignified demeanor invited confidence. 'Oh, Uncle George,' she would say, 'surely it isn't wrong of me to dream of a future with Leander. I see him now as the greatest basketball player in the world, as the pick and cream of the great professionals, as the owner of a long-term, large-sized contract. It's not as if I ask for much. All I want out of life is a little vine-covered mansion, a small garden stretching out as far as the eye can see, a simple staff of servants organized into squads, all my clothing arranged alphabetically for each day of the week and each month of the year, and... I was forced to interrupt her charming prattle. "Little one," I said, "there is a tiny flaw in your scheme. Leander is not a very good basketball player, and it is unlikely that he will be signed up for enormous sums in salary." "That's so unfair," she said, pouting. "Why isn't he a very good basketball player?" "Because that is the way the universe works. Why do you not pin your young affections on someone who is a good basketball player? Or, for that matter, on some honest young Wall Street broker who happens to have access to inside information?" "Actually, I've thought of that myself, Uncle George. But I like Leander all by himself. There are times when I think of him and say to myself, is money really all that important?" "Hush, little one," I said, shocked. Women these days are incredibly outspoken. "But why can't I have the money, too? Is that so much to ask?" "Actually, was it? After all, I had a demon all my own. It was a little demon, to be sure, but his heart was big. Surely he would want to help out the course of true love, in order to bring sweetness and light to two souls whose two hearts beat as one at the thought of mutual kisses and mutual funds." Azazel did listen when I summoned him with the appropriate name of power. "No, I can't tell you what it is. Have you no sense of elementary ethics?" As I say, he did listen, but with what I felt to be a lack of that true sympathy one would expect. I admit I had dragged him into our own continuum from what was an indulgence in something like a Turkish bath, for he was wrapped in a tiny towel and he was shivering. His voice seemed higher and squeakier than ever. Actually, I don't think it was truly his voice. I think he communicated by telepathy of some sort, but the result was that I heard, or imagined I heard, a squeaky voice. "What is basketball?" he said. "A ball shaped like a basket? Because if it is, what is a basket?" I tried to explain, but for a demon, he can be very dense. He kept staring at me as though I were not explaining every bit of the game with luminous clarity. He said finally, "Is it possible for me to see a game of basketball?" "Certainly," I said. "There will be a game tonight. I have a ticket which Leander gave me, and you can come in my pocket." "Fine," said Azazel. "Call me back when you are ready to leave for the game. Right now I must finish my zimjig," by which I suppose he meant his Turkish bath, and he disappeared. I must admit that I find it most irritating to have someone place his puny and parochial affairs ahead of the matters of great moment in which I am engaged. Which reminds me, old man, that the waiter seems to be trying to attract your attention. I think he has your check for you. Please take it from him and let me get ahead with my story. I went to the basketball game that night, and Azazel was with me in my pocket. He kept poking his head above the edge of the pocket in order to watch the game, and he would have made a questionable sight if anyone had been watching. His skin is a bright red, and on his forehead are two nubbins of horns. It is fortunate, of course, that he didn't come out altogether, for his centimeter-long muscular tail is both his most prominent and his most nauseating feature. I am not a great basketball aficionado myself, and I rather left it to Azazel to make sense out of what was happening. His intelligence, although demonic rather than human, is intense. After the game, he said to me, "It seems to me, as nearly as I could make out from the strenuous action of the bulky, clumsy, and totally uninteresting individuals in the arena, that there was excitement every time that peculiar ball passed through a hoop." "That's it," I said. "You score a basket, you see." "Then this protege of yours would become a heroic player of this stupid game if he could throw the ball through the hoop every time?" "Exactly." Azazel twirled his tail thoughtfully. "That should not be difficult. I need only adjust his reflexes in order to make him judge the angle, height, force." He fell into a ruminative silence for a moment, then said, "Let's see. I noted and recorded his personal coordinate complex during the game. Yes, it can be done. In fact, it is done. Your Leander will have no trouble in getting the ball through the hoop. I felt a certain excitement as I waited for the next scheduled game. I did not say a word to little Juniper because I had never made use of Azazel's demonic powers before, and I wasn't entirely sure that his deeds would match his words. Besides, I wanted her to be surprised. As it turned out, she was very surprised, as was I. The day of the game came at last, and it was the game. Our local college, Nerdsville Tech, of whose basketball team Leander was so dim a luminary, was playing the lanky bruisers of the Al Capone College Reformatory, and it was expected to be an epic combat. How epic, no one expected. The Capone Five swept into an early lead, and I watched Leander keenly. He seemed to have trouble in deciding what to do, and at first his hand seemed to miss the ball when he tried to dribble. His reflexes, I guessed, had been so altered that at first he could not control his muscles at all. But then, it was as though he grew accustomed to his new body. He seized the ball, and it seemed to slip from his hands. But what a slip! It arced high into the air and through the center of the hoop. A wild cheer shook the stands while Leander stared thoughtfully up at the hoop, as though wondering what had happened. Whatever had happened, happened again. And again. As soon as Leander touched the ball, it arced. As soon as it arced, it curved into the basket. It would happen so suddenly that no one ever saw Leander aim or make any effort at all. Interpreting this as sheer expertise, the crowd grew the more hysterical. But then, of course, the inevitable happened, and the game descended into total chaos. Catcalls erupted from the stands. The scarred and broken-nosed alumni who were rooting for Capone Reformatory made violent remarks of a derogatory nature, and fistfights blossomed in every corner of the audience. What I had failed to tell Azazel, you see, thinking it to be self-evident, and what Azazel had failed to realize, was that the two baskets on the court were not identical, that one was the home basket and the other the visitor's basket, and that each player aimed for the appropriate basket. The basketball, with all the lamentable ignorance of an inanimate object, arced for whichever basket was nearer once Leander seized it. The result was that time and again, Leander would manage to put the ball into the wrong basket. He persisted in doing so despite the kindly remonstrances of Nerdsville coach, Claus Pop McFang, which he shrieked through the foam that covered his lips. Pop McFang bared his teeth in a sigh of sadness at having to eject Leander from the game, and wept openly when they removed his fingers from Leander's throat so that the ejection could be carried through. My friend Leander was never the same again. I had thought, naturally, that he would find escape in drink and become a stern and thoughtful wino. I would have understood that. He sank lower than that, however. He turned to his studies. Under the contemptuous and even sometimes pitying eyes of his schoolmates, he slunk from lecture to lecture, buried his head in books, and receded into the dank depths of scholarship. Yet, through it all, Juniper clung to him. "He needs me," she said, her eyes misting with unshed tears. Sacrificing all, she married him after they graduated. She then clung to him even while he sank to the lowest depths of all, being stigmatized with a Ph.D. in physics. He and Juniper live now in a small co-op on the Upper West Side somewhere. He teaches physics and does research in cosmogony, I understand. He earns $60,000 a year and is spoken of in shocked whispers by those who knew him when he was a respectable jock as a possible candidate for the Nobel Prize. Juniper never complains, but remains faithful to her fallen idol. Neither by word nor deed does she ever express any sense of loss, but she cannot fool her old godfather. I know very well that on occasion she thinks wistfully of the vine-covered mansion she'll never have, and of the rolling hills and distant horizons of her small dream estate. "That's the story," said George, as he scooped up the change the waiter had brought and copied down the total from the credit card receipt, so that he might take it off as a tax deduction, I assume. "If I were you," he added, "I would leave a generous tip." I did so, rather in a daze, as George smiled and walked away. I didn't really mind the loss of the change. It occurred to me that George got only a meal, whereas I had a story I could tell as my own, and which would earn me many times the cost of the meal. In fact, I decided to continue having dinner with him now and then. One Night of Song. As it happens, I have a friend who hints sometimes that he can call up spirits from the vasty deep. Or at least one spirit, a tiny one with strictly limited powers. He talks about it sometimes, but only after he has reached his fourth scotch and soda. It's a delicate point of equilibrium. 3, and he knows nothing about spirits, the supernatural kind. 5, and he falls asleep. I thought he'd reached the right level that evening, so I said, "Do you remember that spirit of yours, George?" "Eh?" said George, looking at his drink as though he wondered why that should require remembering. "Not your drink," I said. "The little spirit about 2 centimeters high, whom you once told me you had managed to call up from some other place of existence. The one with the paranatural powers." "Ah," said George, "Azazel." Not his name, of course. Couldn't pronounce his real name, I suppose, but that's what I call him.
"I remember him."
"Do you use him much?" "No. Dangerous. It's too dangerous. There's always the temptation to play with power. I'm careful myself, deuced careful. As you know, I have a high standard of ethics. That's why I felt called upon to help a friend once. The damage that did, dreadful, doesn't bear thinking of." "What happened?" "I suppose I ought to get it off my chest," said George thoughtfully. "It tends to fester." "I was a good deal younger then," said George. "And in those days, women made up an important part of one's life. It seems silly now, looking back on it, but I distinctly remember thinking back in those days that it made much difference which woman. Actually, you reach in the grab bag, and whichever comes out, it's much the same. But in those days, I had a friend, Mortensen. Andrew Mortensen. I don't think you know him. I haven't seen much of him myself in recent years. The point is, he was soppy about a woman, a particular woman. She was an angel, he said. He couldn't live without her. She was the only one in the universe, and without her the world was crumbled bacon bits dipped in axle grease. You know the way lovers talk. The trouble was, she threw him over finally, and apparently did so in a particularly cruel manner, and without regard for his self-esteem. She had humiliated him thoroughly, taking up with another right in front of him, snapping her fingers under his nostrils, and laughing heartlessly at his tears. I don't mean that literally. I'm just trying to give the impression he gave me. He sat here drinking with me, here in this very room. My heart bled for him, and I said, 'I'm sorry, Mortensen, but you mustn't take on so. When you stop to think of it clearly, she's only a woman. If you look out in the street, there are lots of them passing by.' He said bitterly, 'I intend a womanless existence from now on, old man. Except for my wife, of course, whom every now and then I can't avoid. It's just that I'd like to do something in return to this woman.' 'To your wife?' I said. 'No, no, why should I like to do something to my wife? I'm talking about doing something for this woman who threw me over so heartlessly.' 'Like what?' 'Damned if I know,' said he. 'Maybe I can help,' I said, for my heart was still bleeding for him. 'I can make use of a spirit with quite extraordinary powers. A small spirit, of course.' I held my finger and thumb up less than an inch apart so that he was sure to get the idea. 'Who can only do so much?' I told him about Azazel, and of course he believed me. I've often noticed that I carry conviction when I tell a tale. Now, when you tell a story, old man, the air of disbelief that descends upon the room is thick enough to cut with a chainsaw, but it's not that way with me. There's nothing like a reputation for probity and an air of honest directness.' His eyes glittered as I told him. He said could he arrange to give her something that I would ask for. 'If it's presentable, old man, I hope you have nothing in your mind like making her smell bad or having a toad drop out of her mouth when she talks.' 'Of course not,' he said, revolted. 'What do you take me for? She gave me 2 happy years on and off, and I want to make an adequate return. You say your spirit has only limited power?' 'He's a small thing,' I said, holding up my thumb and forefinger again. 'Could he give her a perfect voice? For a time, anyway. At least for one performance.' 'I'll ask him.' Mortensen's suggestion sounded the gentlemanly thing to do. His ex-mistress sang cantatas at the local church, if that's the proper term. In those days I had quite an ear for music and would frequently go to these things, taking care to dodge the collection box, of course. I rather enjoyed hearing her sing, and the audience seemed to absorb it politely enough. I thought at the time that her morals didn't quite suit the surroundings, but Mortensen said they made allowances for sopranos. So I consulted Azazel. He was quite willing to help. None of this nonsense, you know, of demanding my soul in exchange. I remember I once asked Azazel if he wanted my soul, and he didn't even know what it was. He asked me what I meant, and it turned out I didn't know what it was either. It's just that he's such a little fellow in his own universe that it gives him a feeling of great success to be able to throw his weight around in our universe. He likes to help out. He said he could manage 3 hours, and Mortensen said that would be perfect when I gave him the news. We picked a night when she was going to be singing Bach or Handel or one of those old piano bangers, and was going to have a long and impressive solo. Mortensen went to the church that night, and of course I went too. I felt responsible for what was going to happen, and I thought I had better oversee the situation. Mortensen said gloomily, "I attended the rehearsals. She was just singing the same way she always did. You know, as though she had a tail and someone was stepping on it." That wasn't the way he used to describe her voice. "The music of the spheres," he said on a number of occasions, and it was all uphill from there. Of course, though, he had been thrown over, which does warp a man's judgment. I fixed him with a censorious eye. "That's no way to talk of a woman you're trying to bestow a great gift upon." "That's just it. I want her voice to be perfect, really perfect. And I now see, now that the mists of love have cleared from my eyes, that she has a long way to go. Do you think your spirit can handle it?" "The change isn't timed to start until 8:15 p.m. A stab of suspicion went through me. "You hadn't been hoping to use up the perfection on the rehearsal and then disappoint the audience." "You have it all wrong," he said. They got started a little early, and when she got up in her white dress to sing, it was 8:14 by my old pocket watch, which is never off by more than 2 seconds. She wasn't one of your pee-wee sopranos. She was built on a generous scale, leaving lots of room for the kind of resonance you need when you reach for that high note and drown out the orchestra. Whenever she drew in a few gallons of breath with which to manipulate it all, I could see what Mortensen saw in her, allowing for several layers of textile material. She started at her usual level, and then at 8:15 precisely, it was as though another voice had been added. I saw her give a little jump, as though she didn't believe what she heard, and one hand, which was held to her diaphragm, seemed to vibrate. Her voice soared. It was as though she had become an organ in perfect pitch. Each note was perfect, a note invented freshly at that moment, besides which all other notes of the same pitch and quality were imperfect copies. Each note hit squarely with just the proper vibrato, if that's the word, swelling or diminishing with enormous power and control. And she got better with each note. The organist wasn't looking at the music, he was looking at her. And I can't swear to it, but I think he stopped playing. If he were playing, I wouldn't have heard him anyway. There was no way in which you could hear anything while she was singing. Anything else but her. The look of surprise had vanished from her face, and there was a look of exultation there instead. She had put down the music she had been holding. She didn't need it. Her voice was singing by itself, and she didn't need to control or direct it. The conductor was rigid, and everyone else in the chorus seemed dumbfounded. The solo ended at last, and the chorus sounded in what was a whisper, as though they were all ashamed of their voices and distressed to turn them loose in the same church on the same night. For the rest of the program, it was all her. When she sang, it was all that was heard, even if every other voice was sounding. When she didn't sing, it was as though we were sitting in the dark and we couldn't bear the absence of light. And when it was over, well, you don't applaud in church, but they did then. Everyone in that church stood up as though they had been yanked to their feet by a single marionette string, and they applauded and applauded, and it was clear they would applaud all night unless she sang again. She did sing again, her voice alone, with the organ whispering hesitantly in the background, with the spotlight on her, with no one else in the chorus visible. Effortless. You have no idea how effortless it was. I wrenched my ears away from the sound to try to watch her breathing, to catch her taking in breath, to wonder how long a note could be held at full volume with only one pair of lungs to supply the air. But it had to end, and it was over. Even the applause was over. It was only then that I became aware that Next to me, Mortensen had been sitting with his eyes glittering, with his whole being absorbed in her singing. It was only then that I began to gather what had happened. I am, after all, as straight as a Euclidean line and have no deviousness in me, so I couldn't be expected to see what he was after. You, on the other hand, who are so crooked you can run up a spiral staircase without making any turns, can see at a glance what he was after. She had sung perfectly, but she would never sing perfectly again. It was as though she were blind from birth, and for just 3 hours could see all there was to see, all the colors and shapes and wonders that surround us all, and that we pay no attention to because we're so used to it. Suppose you could see it all in its full glory for just 3 hours, and then be blind again. You could stand your blindness if you knew nothing else. But to know something else briefly and then return to blindness? No one could stand that. That woman has never sung again, of course. But that's only part of it. The real tragedy was to us, to the members of the audience. We had perfect music for 3 hours, perfect music. Do you think we could ever again bear to listen to anything less than that? I've been as good as tone deaf ever since. Recently, I went to one of those rock festivals that are so popular these days just to test myself out. You won't believe me, but I couldn't make out one tune. It was all noise to me. My only consolation is that Mortensen, who listened most eagerly and with the most concentration, is worse off than anyone in that audience. He wears earplugs at all times. He can't stand any sound above a whisper. Serves him right. The Smile That Loses. I said to my friend George over a beer recently, his beer, I was having a ginger ale, "How's your implant these days?" George claims he has a 2-centimeter-tall demon at his beck and call. I can never get him to admit he's lying, neither can anyone else. He glared at me balefully, then said, "Oh, yes, you're the one who knows about it. I hope you haven't told anyone else." "Not a word," I said. "It's quite sufficient that I think you're crazy. I don't need anyone thinking the same of me." Besides, he had told at least half a dozen people about the demon, to my personal knowledge, so there's no necessity of my being indiscreet. George said, "I wouldn't have your unlovely inability to believe anything you don't understand, and you don't understand so much, for the worth of a pound of plutonium. And what would be left of you if my demon ever found out you called him an implant wouldn't be worth an atom of plutonium." "Have you figured out his real name?" I asked, unperturbed by this dire warning.
"Can't. It's unpronounceable by any earthly pair of lips.
The translation is, I am given to understand, something like, 'I am the King of Kings, look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair.'" "It's a lie, of course," said George, staring moodily at his beer. "He's small potatoes in his world. That's why he's so cooperative here. In our world, with our primitive technology, he can show off." "Has he shown off lately?" "Yes, as a matter of fact," said George, heaving an enormous sigh and raising his bleak blue eyes to mine. His ragged white mustache settled down only slowly from the typhoon of that forced exhalation of breath. "It started with Rosie O'Donnell," said George, "a friend of a niece of mine, and a fetching little thing altogether. She had blue eyes, almost as brilliant as my own.
Russet hair, long and lustrous.
A delightful little nose, powdered with freckles in the manner approved of by all who write romances. A graceful neck, a slender figure that wasn't opulent in any disproportionate way, but was utterly delightful in its promise of ecstasy. Of course, all of this was of purely intellectual interest to me, since I reached the age of discretion years ago, and now engage in the consequences of physical affection only when women insist upon it, which, thank the fates, is not oftener than an occasional weekend or so. Besides which, Rosie had recently married, and for some reason adored in the most aggravating manner, a large Irishman who does not attempt to hide the fact that he is a very muscular and possibly bad-tempered person. While I had no doubt that I would have been able to handle him in my younger days, the sad fact was that I was no longer in my younger days, by a short margin. It was therefore with a certain reluctance that I accepted Rosie's tendency to mistake me for some close friend of her own sex and her own time of life, and to make me the object of her girlish confidences. Not that I blame her, you understand. My natural dignity, and the fact that I inevitably remind people of one or more of the nobler of the Roman emperors in appearance automatically attracts beautiful young women to me. Nevertheless, I never allowed it to go too far. I always made sure there was plenty of space between Rosie and myself, for I wanted no fables or distortions to reach the undoubtedly large and possibly bad-tempered Kevin O'Donnell. "Oh, George," said Rosie one day, clapping her little hands with glee, "you have no idea what a darling my Kevin is, and how happy he makes me. Do you know what he does?" "I'm not sure," I began cautiously, naturally expecting indelicate disclosures, "that you ought to..." She paid no attention. "He has a way of crinkling up his nose and making his eyes twinkle and smiling brightly, till everything about him looks so happy. It's as though the whole world turns into golden sunshine. Oh, if only I had a photograph of him exactly like that. I've tried to take one, but I never catch him quite right." I said, "Why not be satisfied with the real thing, my dear?" "Oh, well," she hesitated, then said with the most charming blush, "he's not always like that, you know. He's got a very difficult job at the airport, and sometimes he comes home just worn out and exhausted, and then he becomes just a little touchy and scowls at me a bit. If I had a photograph of him, as he really is, it would be such a comfort to me. Such a comfort." And her blue eyes misted over with unshed tears. I must admit that I had the merest trifle of an impulse to tell her of Azazel. That's what I call him, because I'm not going to call him by what he tells me the translation of his real name is, and to explain what he might do for her. However, I'm unutterably discreet. I haven't the faintest notion how you managed to find out about my demon. Besides, it was easy for me to fight off the impulse, for I am a hard-shelled, realistic human being, not given to silly sentiment. I admit I have a semi-soft spot in my rugged heart for sweet young women of extraordinary beauty, in a dignified and avuncular manner, mostly. And it occurred to me that, after all, I could oblige her without actually telling her about Azazel. Not that she would have disbelieved me, of course, for I am a man whose words carry conviction with all but those who, like you, are psychotic. I referred the matter to Azazel, who was by no means pleased. He said, "You keep asking for abstractions." I said, "Not at all. I ask for a simple photograph. All you have to do is materialize it." "Oh, is that all I have to do? If it's that simple, you do it. I trust you understand the nature of mass-energy equivalents." "Just one photograph?" "Yes, and with an expression of something you can't even define or describe." I've never seen him look at me the way he would look at his wife, naturally, but I have infinite faith in your ability. I rather expected that a helping of sickening praise would fetch him round. He said sulkily, "You'll have to take the photograph." I couldn't get the proper... "You don't have to. I'll take care of that, but it would be much easier if I had a material object on which to focus the abstraction. A photograph, in other words. One of the most inadequate kind, even. The sort I would expect of you. And only one copy, of course. I cannot manage more than that, and I will not sprain my subjunctival muscle for you or for any other pinheaded being in your world." Oh, well, he's frequently crotchety. I expect that simply to establish the importance of his role and impress you with the fact that you must not take him for granted. I met the O'Donnells the next Sunday on their way back from Mass. I lay in wait for them, actually. They were willing to let me snap a picture of them in their Sunday finery. She was delighted, and he looked a bit grumpy about it. After that, just as unobtrusively as possible, I took a headshot of Kevin. There was no way I could get him to smile or dimple or crinkle or whatever it was that Rosie found so attractive, but I didn't feel that mattered. I wasn't even sure that the camera was focused correctly. After all, I'm not one of your great photographers. I then visited a friend of mine who was a photography whiz. He developed both snaps and enlarged the headshot to an 8x11. He did it rather grumpily, muttering something about how busy he was, though I paid no attention to that. After all, what possible value can his foolish activities have in comparison to the important matters that occupied me? I'm always surprised at the number of people who don't understand this. When he completed the enlargement, however, he changed his attitude entirely. He stared at it and said, in what I can only describe as a completely offensive tone, "Don't tell me you managed to take a photo like this." "Why not?" I said. and held out my hand for it, but he made no move to give it to me. "You'll want more copies," he said. "No, I won't," I said, looking over his shoulder. It was a remarkably clear photograph in brilliant color. Kevin O'Donnell was smiling, though I didn't remember such a smile at the time I snapped it. He seemed good-looking and cheerful, but I was rather indifferent to that. Perhaps a woman might observe more, or a man like my photographer friend, who, as it happened, did not have my firm grasp on masculinity, might do so. He said, "Just one more, for me." "No," I said firmly, and took the picture, grasping his wrist to make sure he would not withdraw it. "And the negative, please. You can keep the other one, the distance shot." "I don't want that," he said petulantly, and was looking quite woebegone as I left. I framed the picture, put it on my mantelpiece, and stepped back to look at it. There was indeed a remarkable glow about it. Azazel had done a good job. What would Rosie's reaction be, I wondered. I phoned her and asked if I could drop by. It turned out that she was going shopping, but if I could be there within the hour... I could, and I was. I had the photo gift-wrapped and handed it to her without a word. "My goodness," she said, even as she cut the string and tore off the wrapping. "What is this? Is there some celebration, or..." By then she had it out, and her voice died away. Her eyes widened, and her breath became shorter and more rapid. Finally she whispered, "Oh, my!" She looked up at me. "Did you take this photograph last Sunday?" I nodded. "But you caught him exactly. He's adorable. That's just the look. Oh, may I please keep it?"
"I brought it for you," I said simply.
She threw her arms about me and kissed me hard on the lips. Unpleasant, of course, for a person like myself who detests sentiment, and I had to wipe my mustache afterward, but I could understand her inability to resist the gesture. I didn't see Rosie for about a week afterward. Then I met her outside the butcher shop one afternoon, and it would have been impolite not to offer to carry the shopping bag home for her. Naturally, I wondered whether that would mean another kiss, and I decided it would be rude to refuse if the dear little thing insisted. She looked somewhat downcast, however. "How's the photograph?" I asked, wondering whether perhaps it had not worn well. She cheered up at once.
"Perfect! I have it on my record player stand, at an angle such that I can see it when I'm at my chair at the dining room table. His eyes just look at me a little slantwise, so roguishly, and his nose had just the right crinkle. Honestly, you'd swear he was alive. And some of my friends can't keep their eyes off it. I'm thinking I should hide it when they come, or they'll steal it."
"They might steal him," I said jokingly. The glumness returned. She shook her head and said,
"I don't think so."
I tried another tack. "What does Kevin think of the photo?"
"He hasn't said a word, not a word. He's not a visual person, you know. I wonder if he sees it at all."
"Why don't you point it out and ask him what he thinks?" She was silent while I trudged along beside her for half a block, carrying that heavy shopping bag and wondering if she'd expect a kiss in addition.
"Actually," she said suddenly, "he's having a lot of tension at work, so it wouldn't be a good time to ask him. He gets home late and hardly talks to me. Well, you know how men are."
She tried to put a tinkle in her laughter, but failed. We had reached her apartment house, and I turned the bag over to her. She said wistfully,
"But thank you once again, and over for the photograph."
Off she went. She didn't ask for a kiss, and I was so lost in thought that I didn't notice that fact till I was halfway home, and it seemed silly to return merely to keep her from being disappointed. About 10 more days passed, and then she called me one morning. Could I drop in and have lunch with her? I held back and pointed out that it would be indiscreet. What would the neighbors think?
"Oh, that's silly," she said. "You're so incredibly old. I mean, you're such an incredibly old friend that they couldn't possibly... Besides, I want your advice."
It seemed to me she was suppressing a sob as she said that. Well, one must be a gentleman, so I was in her sunny little apartment at lunchtime. She'd prepared ham and cheese sandwiches and slivers of apple pie, and there was the photograph on the record player, as she had said. She shook hands with me and made no attempt to kiss me, which would have relieved me were it not for the fact that I was too disturbed at her appearance to feel any relief. She looked absolutely haggard. I ate half a sandwich waiting for her to speak, and when she didn't, I was forced to ask outright for the reason there was such a heavy atmosphere of gloom about her. I said, "Is it Kevin?" I was sure it was. She nodded and burst into tears. I patted her hand and wondered if that was enough. I stroked her shoulder abstractedly, and she finally said, "I'm afraid he's going to lose his job." "Surely not. Why?" "Well, he's so savage, even at work, apparently. He hasn't smiled for ages. He hasn't kissed me or said a kind word since I don't remember when. He quarrels with everyone and all the time. He won't tell me what's wrong, and he gets furious if I ask. A friend of ours who works at the airport with Kevin called up yesterday. He says that Kevin is acting so sullen and unhappy at the job that the higher-ups are noticing. I'm sure he'll lose his job, but what can I do?" I had been expecting something like this ever since our last meeting, actually, and I knew I would simply have to tell her the truth. Damn that Azazel. I cleared my throat. "Rosie, the photograph." "Yes, I know," she said, snatching it up and hugging it to her breasts. "It's what keeps me going. This is the real Kevin, and I'll always have him, always, no matter what happens." She began to sob. I found it very hard to say what had to be said, but there was no way out. I said, "You don't understand, Rosie. It's the photograph that's the problem. I'm sure of it. All that charm and cheerfulness in the photograph had to come from somewhere. It had to be scraped off Kevin himself. Don't you understand?" Rosie stopped sobbing.
"What are you talking about? A photograph is just the light being focused, and film, and things like that."
"Ordinarily, yes. But this photograph..." I gave up. I knew Azazel's shortcomings. He couldn't create the magic of the photograph out of nothing. But I wasn't sure I could explain the science of it, the law of conservation of merriment, to Rosie. "Let me put it this way," I said. "As long as that photograph sits there, Kevin will be unhappy, angry, and bad-tempered."
"But it certainly will sit there," said Rosie, putting it firmly back in its place. "And I can't see why you're saying such crazy things about the one wonderful object. Here, I'll make some coffee."
She flounced off to the kitchen, and I could see she was in a most offended state of mind. I did the only thing I could possibly do. After all, I had been the one who had snapped the photograph. I was responsible, through Azazel, for its arcane properties. I snatched up the frame quickly, carefully removed the backing, then the photo itself. I tore the photograph across into two pieces, 4, 8, 16, and placed the final scraps of paper in my pocket. The telephone rang just as I finished, and Rosie bustled into the living room to answer. I restored the backing and set the frame back in place. It sat there, blankly empty. I heard Rosie's voice squealing with excitement and happiness.
"Oh, Kevin," I heard her say, "how wonderful! Oh, I'm so glad! But why didn't you tell me? Don't you ever do that again!"
She came back, pretty face glowing.
"Do you know what that terrible Kevin did? He's had a kidney stone for nearly 3 weeks now, seeing a doctor and all, and in terrible nagging pain and facing possible surgery. And he wouldn't tell me for fear it would cause me worry. The idiot! No wonder he was so miserable. And it never once occurred to him that his misery made me far more unhappy than knowing about it would have. Honestly, a man shouldn't be allowed out without a keeper."
"But why are you so happy now?"
"Because he passed the stone. He just passed it a little while ago, and the first thing he did was to call me, which was very thoughtful of him. And about time. He sounded so happy and cheerful. It was just as though my old Kevin had come back to me. It was as though he had become exactly like the photograph that..."
Then, in half a shriek,
"Where's the photograph?"
I was on my feet, preparing to leave. I was walking rather briskly toward the door, saying, "I destroyed it. That's why he passed the stone. Otherwise..."
"You destroyed it? You...
I was outside the door. I didn't expect gratitude, of course, but what I was expecting was murder. I didn't wait for the elevator, but hastened down the stairs as quickly as I reasonably could, the sound of her long wail penetrating the door and reaching my ears for a full two flights. I burned the scraps of the photograph when I got home. I have never seen her since. From what I have been told, Kevin has been a delightful and loving husband, and they are most happy together. But the one letter I received from her, 7 pages of small writing and nearly incoherent, made it plain that she was of the opinion that the kidney stone was the full explanation of Kevin's ill humor, and that its arrival and departure in exact synchronization with the photograph was sheer coincidence. She made some rather injudicious threats against my life, and quite anticlimactically, against certain portions of my body, making use of words and phrases I would have sworn she had never heard, much less employed. And I suppose she will never kiss me again, something I find, for some odd reason, disappointing.
To the victor.
I don't often see my friend George, but when I do, I make it a practice to ask after this small demon he claims he can call up. A bald and aged science fiction writer, he would say to me, has stated that any technology sufficiently advanced beyond the customary would seem like magic. And yet, my small friend Azazel is no extraterrestrial oddity, but a bona fide demon. He may only be 2 centimeters high, but he can do amazing things. How did you find out about him? By listening to you. George drew his face into vertical, disapproving lines and said sepulchrally, "I never discuss Azazel." "Except when you're talking," I said. "What's he been doing lately?" George fetched a sigh from the region of his toes and expelled it, fairly beer-laden, into the unoffending atmosphere. "There," he said, "you touch a bit of sadness within me. My young friend, Theophilus, is a little the worse for our efforts, mine and Azazel's, although we meant well." He lifted his mug of beer to his face and then went on. "My friend Theophilus," said George, "whom you have never met, for he moves in circles rather higher than the sordid ones you frequent, is a refined young man who is a great admirer of the graceful lines and divine carriage of young women, something to which I am fortunately immune, but who lack the capacity to inspire reciprocation in them. He would say to me, 'I can't understand it, George. I have a good mind. I am an excellent conversationalist, witty, kind, reasonably good-looking.' 'Yes,' I would reply, 'you do have eyes, nose, chin, and mouth all in the usual places and in the usual number. I'll go that far. And incredibly skilled in the theory of love, although I haven't actually been given much chance to put it into practice, and yet I seem to be unable to attract attention from these delightful creatures. Observe that they seem to be all about us, and yet not one makes the slightest attempt to scrape up an acquaintance with me, although I sit here with the most genial expression on my face.' My heart bled for him. I had known him as an infant, when, as I recall, I had once held him at the request of his mother, who was breastfeeding him to repletion, while she rearranged her dress. These things form a bond. I said, 'Would you be happier, my dear friend, if you did attract attention?' 'It would be paradise,' he said simply. Could I deny him paradise? I put the matter to Azazel, who, as usual, was sulky about it. 'Couldn't you ask me for a diamond?' he said. 'I can manage you a good half-carat stone of the first water by rearranging the atoms in a small piece of coal. But irresistibility to women? How do I do that?' 'Couldn't you rearrange some atoms in him?' said I, trying to be helpful. 'I want to do something for him, if only out of regard for his mother's awesome nutritional equipment.' 'Well, let me think. Human beings,' said Azazel, 'secrete pheromones. Of course, with your modern penchant for bathing at every opportunity and for drenching yourselves in artificial scent, you are scarcely aware of the natural way of inspiring sentiment. I can, perhaps, so rearrange your friend's biochemical makeup as to cause the production of unusual quantities of an unusually effective pheromone, when the sight of one of the ungainly females of your repellent species impinges upon his retina.
You mean he'll stink?
Not at all. It will scarcely surface as a conscious odor, but it will have its effect on the female of the species in the form of a dim and atavistic desire to come closer and to smile. She will probably be stimulated to form answering pheromones of her own, and I presume that everything that follows will be automatic.
The very thing, then, I said, for I am certain that young Theophilus will give a good account of himself. He is an upstanding fellow with drive and ambition.
That Azazel's treatment was effective, I discovered when I next stumbled upon Theophilus. It was at a sidewalk cafe. It took me a moment to see him, for what initially attracted my attention was a group of young women distributed in circular symmetry. I am, fortunately, unperturbed by young women, since I have reached the age of discretion. But it was summer, and they were, one and all, dressed in a calculated insufficiency of clothing, which I, as is suitable in a man of discretion, discreetly studied. It was only after several minutes, during which, I remember, I noted the straining intention placed upon a button that kept a particular blouse closed, and speculated whether... But that is neither here nor there. It was only after several minutes that I noted that it was none other than Theophilus who was at the center of the circular arrangement, and who seemed to be the cynosure of these summery women. No doubt the gathering warmth of the afternoon accentuated his pheromonic potency. I made my way into the ring of femininity, and with fatherly smiles and winks and an occasional avuncular pat of the shoulder, sat down at a chair next to Theophilus, one which a winsome lass had vacated for me with a petulant pout. "Theophilus, my young friend," I said, "this is a charming and inspiring sight." It was then I noticed that there was a small frown of appalling sadness upon his face. I said with concern, "What is wrong?" He spoke through motionless lips in a whisper so low I scarcely heard him,
"For God's sake, get me out of here."
I am, of course, as you know, a man of infinite resource. It was the work of a moment for me to rise and say, "Ladies, my young friend here, as the result of a fundamental biologic urge, must visit the men's room. If you will all sit here, he will be right back." We entered the small restaurant and left by the rear door. One of the young ladies, who had biceps that bulged in a most unlovely manner, and who had an equally unlovely streak of suspicion in her, had made her way around to the rear of the restaurant, but we saw her in time and managed to make it to a taxi. She pursued us with appalling fleetness for two blocks. Secure in Theophilus's room, I said, "Clearly, Theophilus, you have discovered the secret of attracting young women. Is not this the paradise you longed for?" "Not quite," said Theophilus as he slowly relaxed in the air conditioning. "They protect each other. I don't know how it happened, but I suddenly discovered some time ago that strange young women would approach me and ask if we had not met in Atlantic City. I have never," he added with indignation, "been in Atlantic City in my life. No sooner had I denied the fact when another would approach and claim that I had just dropped my handkerchief and that she would like to return it. And then a third would come up and say, 'How would you like to get into the movies, kid?' I said, 'All you have to do is pick out one of them. I would take the one who offered to get you into the movies. It's a soft life, and you'd be surrounded by soft starlets.' 'But I can't pick out any of them. They watch each other like hawks. As soon as I seem to be attracted to any one of them, all the rest turn on her and start pulling her hair and pushing her out. I am as womanless as ever I was, and in the old days I at least didn't have to stare at them as they heave their bosoms at me.'" I sighed in sympathy and said, "Why not set up an elimination tournament? When surrounded by ladies, as you were just now, say to them, 'Dear ones, I am profoundly attracted to each and every one of you. Therefore, I will ask you to line up in alphabetical order so that each one of you may kiss me in turn. The one who does so with the most refined abandon will be my guest for the night. The worst that can happen will be that you will get a lot of eager kissing.'"
"Hmm," said Theophilus.
"Why not? To the victor belong the spoils, and I would love being spoiled by the appropriate victor."
He licked his lips and then pursed them and made practice kisses in the air.
I think I could manage. Do you think it would be less wearing if I insisted on hands behind the back while kissing?
I said, on the whole, I think not, Theophilus, my friend. You should be willing to exert some effort in this cause. I suspect that no holds barred would be the better rule.
Perhaps you are right, said Theophilus, never one to cling to his view in the face of advice from one who could recall copious experience in such matters.
It was about this time that I had to venture out of town on business, and it was not until a month had passed that I met Theophilus again. It was in a supermarket, and there he was pushing a cart that was moderately filled with groceries. The look on his face smote me. It was a hunted one, as he looked this way and that. I came up to him, and he ducked with a strangled cry. Then he recognized me and said, "Thank God, I was afraid you were a woman." I shook my head. "Still that problem. You did not hold the elimination tournament then." "I tried. That was the problem."
"What happened?"
"Well," he looked this way and that, then moved to one side to peer down an aisle. Satisfied that the coast was clear, he spoke to me in a soft and hurried tone, like one who knew that discretion was necessary and that time was limited. "I arranged it," he said. "I had them fill out applications, complete with age, brand of mouthwash used, references, all the usual, and then I set the date. I had arranged to hold the tournament in the grand ballroom of the Waldorf Astoria, with an ample supply of lip salve, and with the services of a professional masseur, plus a tank of oxygen to keep me in shape. The day before the tournament, however, a man came to my apartment. I say a man, but to my dazzled eyes, he seemed more like an animated heap of bricks. He was 7 feet tall and 5 feet broad, with fists the size of steam shovels. He smiled, revealing fangs, and said, 'Sir, my sister is one of those who will compete in the tournament tomorrow.' 'How pleased I am to hear that,' I said, eager to keep the discussion on a friendly plane. 'My little sister,' he said, 'a delicate flower on the rough ancestral tree. She is the apple of the eye of my three brothers and myself, and not one of us could bear the thought of her being disappointed.' 'Do your brothers resemble you, sir?' I asked. 'Not at all,' he said sorrowfully. 'As a result of childhood illness, I have been stunted and wizened all my life. My brothers, however, are fine figures of men who stand this high.' He lifted his hand to a point about 8.5 feet above the ground. 'I am sure,' I said fervently, 'your charming sister will have an excellent chance.' 'I am delighted to hear that. Actually, I am gifted with second sight, in compensation, I think, for my unfortunate puniness of physique. And somehow I am certain that my little sister will win the competition. For some strange reason,' he went on, 'my little sister has taken a girlish liking to you, and my brothers and myself would feel lower than hound dogs if she were disappointed. And if we were—' He grinned even more fangily than before, and slowly cracked the knuckles of his right hand one by one, making a sound like that of thigh bones breaking. I had never heard a thigh bone break, but a sudden surge of second sight told me that was what the sound was like. I said, 'I have a feeling, sir, that you may be right. Do you have a photograph of the damsel for reference?' 'Oddly enough,' he said, 'I have.' He produced one in a frame, and for a moment I must admit my heart sank. I didn't see how she could possibly win the competition. And yet, there must be something to second sight, for despite the odds against her, the young lady won a clear victory. There was a near approach to a riot when that fact was announced, but the winner herself cleared the room with marvelous celerity, and ever since we have been, unfortunately, or rather fortunately, inseparable. In fact, there she is, hovering over the meat counter. She is a great eater of meat, sometimes cooked.' I saw the maiden in question and at once recognized her as the one who had chased our taxi for 2 blocks. Clearly a determined young woman. I admired her rippling biceps, her sturdy gastrocnemiae,
and her strong eyebrow ridges. I said, "You know, Theophilus, it may be possible to decrease your attraction to women to its former insignificant level." Theophilus sighed. "I wouldn't feel safe. My fiancé and her amply designed brothers might misinterpret her loss of interest. Besides, there are compensations. I can, for instance, walk any street in the city at any hour of the night, no matter how intrinsically dangerous that might be, and feel totally secure if she is with me. The most unreasonable traffic policeman is sweetness itself if she chances to frown upon him. And she is both outgoing and innovative in her demonstrations of affection. No, George, I accept my fate. On the 15th of next month, we will marry, and she will carry me over the threshold of the new home which her brothers have supplied us. They have amassed a fortune in the car compacting business, you see, because of their low overhead. They use their hands. It's just that sometimes I long..." His eyes had wandered involuntarily to the fragile form of a fair young woman who was strolling down the aisle toward him. She happened to look at him even as he looked at her, and a tremor seemed to course over her being. "Pardon me," she said shyly, her voice a musical lilt, "but didn't you and I meet in a Turkish bath recently?" Even as she said that, there was the sound of firm footsteps from behind us, and we were interrupted by a wrathful baritone. "Theophilus, my sweet," it said, "are you being annoyed by this floozy?" Theophilus's light of love, her forehead tightened into a magnificent frown, bore down upon the young lady, who shrank in upon herself in obvious terror. I quickly interposed myself between the two women, at considerable risk to myself, of course, but I am well known to be as brave as a lion. I said, "This sweet child is my niece, madam." Having spied me from a distance, she had hastened in this direction to imprint a chaste kiss upon my forehead. That this also carried her in the direction of your dear Theophilus was a complete but inevitable coincidence. It distressed me that the ugly streak of suspicion I had noted in Theophilus's lovely lady on our first meeting now evidenced itself again. "Oh, yeah," she said, in a tone utterly lacking in that bonhomie I would have liked to find. "In that case, let me see you leave, both of you, right now." On the whole, I felt it wise to do so. I linked arms with the young lady, and we walked away, leaving Theophilus to his fate. "Oh, sir," said the young lady, "that was terribly brave and quick-witted of you. Had you not come to my rescue, I must surely have suffered assorted scratches and contusions." "Which would have been a shame," I said gallantly, "for a body such as yours was surely not made for scratches, or for contusions either. Come, you mentioned a Turkish bath. Let us seek one together. In my apartment, as it happens, I have one, or at least an American bath, which is virtually the same thing. After all, to the victor." The Dim Rumble. I try hard not to believe what my friend George tells me. How can I possibly believe a man who tells me he has access to a 2-centimeter-tall demon he calls Azazel, a demon who is really an extraterrestrial personage of extraordinary but strictly limited powers? And yet, George does have this ability to gaze at me unblinkingly out of his blue eyes and make me believe him temporarily, while he's talking. It's the Ancient Mariner effect, I suppose. I once told him that I thought his little demon had given him the gift of verbal hypnosis, but George sighed and said, "Not at all. If he has given me anything, it is a curse for attracting confidences, except that that has been my bane since long before I ever encountered Azazel. The most extraordinary people insist on burdening me with their tales of woe. And sometimes..." He shook his head in deep dejection. "Sometimes," he said, "the load I must bear as a result is more than human flesh and blood should be called upon to endure. Once, for instance, I met a man named Hannibal West. I noticed him first," said George,
in the lounge of a hotel at which I was staying. I noticed him chiefly because he encumbered my view of a statuesque waitress who was most becomingly and insufficiently dressed. I presume he thought I was looking at him, something I would certainly not willingly have done, and he took it as an overture of friendship. He came to my table bringing his drink with him, and seated himself without a by your leave. I am by nature a courteous man, and so I greeted him with a friendly grunt and glare, which he accepted in a calm way. He had sandy hair plastered down across his scalp, pale eyes, and an equally pale face, together with the concentrated gaze of a fanatic, though I admit I didn't notice that until later on. "My name," he said, "is Hannibal West, and I am a professor of geology. My particular field of interest is speleology. You wouldn't, by any chance, be a speleologist yourself?" I knew at once he was under the impression he had recognized a kindred soul. My gorge rose at the possibility, but I remained courteous. "I am interested in all strange words," I said. "What is speleology?" "Caves," he said. "The study and exploration of caves. That is my hobby, sir. I have explored caves on every continent except Antarctica. I know more about caves than anyone in the world." "Very pleasant," I said, "and impressive." Feeling that I had in this way concluded a most unsatisfactory encounter, I signaled for the waitress to renew my drink and watched in scientific absorption her undulating progress across the room. Hannibal West did not recognize the conclusion, however. "Yes," he said, nodding vigorously. "You do well to say it is impressive. I have explored caves that are unknown to the world. I have entered underground grottos that have never felt the footsteps of a human being. I am one of the few people alive today who has gone where no man, or woman for that matter, has ever gone before. I have breathed air undisturbed till then by the lungs of a human being, and have seen sights and heard sounds no one else has ever seen or heard. And lived." He shuddered. My drink had arrived, and I took it gratefully, admiring the grace with which the waitress bent low to place it on the table before me. I said, my mind not really on what I was saying, "You are a fortunate man." "That I am not," said West. "I am a miserable sinner called upon by the Lord to avenge the sins of humanity." Now at last I looked at him sharply and noted a glare of fanaticism that nearly pinned me to the wall. "In caves?" I asked. "In caves," he said solemnly. "Believe me, as a professor of geology, I know what I am talking about." I had met numerous professors in my lifetime who had known no such thing, but I forbore mentioning the fact. Perhaps West read my opinion in my expressive eyes, for he fished a newspaper clipping out of a briefcase at his feet and passed it over to me. "Here," he said, "just look at that." I cannot say that it much rewarded close study. It was a 3-paragraph item from some local newspaper. The headline read, "A Dim Rumble," and the dateline was East Fishkill, New York. It was an account to the effect that local residents had complained to the police department of a dim rumble that left them uneasy and caused much disturbance among the cat and dog population of the town. The police had dismissed it as the sound of a distant thunderstorm, though the weather department heatedly denied having produced any that day anywhere in the region.
"What do you think of that?" asked West.
"Might it have been a mass epidemic of indigestion?" He sneered as though the suggestion were beneath contempt, though no one who has ever experienced indigestion would consider it that. "Beneath the diaphragm, perhaps."
He said, "I have similar news items from papers in Liverpool, England, Bogota, Colombia, Milan, Italy, Rangoon, Burma, and perhaps 60 other places the world over. I collected them. All speak of a pervasive dim rumble that created fear and uneasiness and drove animals frantic, and all were reported within a 2-day period."
"A single worldwide event," I said. Exactly. Indigestion, indeed.